Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Yo, hoi, hoi, hoi. Dr. Spencer here. Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast. Got my co-host, Dr. Carl. We're going to be talking about some updates to obesity medicine, along with some kind of tidbits of some of these BS supplements that are out there that claim to be nature's Ozempic. We've talked about our product in the past called Glycosol when I was in medical school. It had an active ingredient called berberine, and we were the first people in the United States to sell it at that clinical dose of 500 milligrams of pure berberine HCL per day. But there's some other supplements. Everybody's jumping on the bandwagon and trying to get a piece of that pie. We're going to also talk about some of these other new agonists out there. We've kind of mentioned these before, but there's an amylin hormone that comes, that's actually co-secreted with insulin from our pancreas.
We'll talk about it.
And so we're going to talk about some of these agonists out there that are mimicking that, along with some other step trials, which is semaglutide, which, and as an aside, some people have said, hey, you're pronouncing that incorrectly. And I will say that I had it straight from the horse's mouth of Novo Nordisk. I am not pronouncing it incorrectly. It's pretty, semaglutide, not
pretty
semaglutide.
Sure that the researchers and endocrinologists, the people actually doing this stuff for the past, you know, 20, 30, 40 years have always called them exenatide, liraglutide, semaglutide, tirzepatide, and presumably retatrutide. The correct emphasis on the correct syllable.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So anyway, that's just a funny thing because everybody says semaglutide. And one time I was talking about Jillian Michaels. I did a little thing on her. It was like...
Which she hasn't published our podcast. Yeah, we did our podcast with her and she hasn't published
like
it yet.
Like, God, that was that in June?
It was in June. It was June 16th. Jillian, like, come on. Release this. I'm a little worried that their producers are like, you didn't come across that well, but I don't know.
3 months ago. So it hasn't been... Anyway, I was talking, saying semaglutide, and somebody in the comments like, how can I trust a doctor when who doesn't even pronounce it right? I'm like, listen here.
You know, that's the one mistake I think South Park made, because Cartman was like, semaglutide.
Semaglutide.
Yeah. So for anybody wondering, so Spencer said that we've had complaints about my microphone. So
always. It's either my microphone or yours.
I am holding it closer to my mouth.
Yeah,
and I'm going to use a radio voice.
Yeah, we see. I have to click on normalize the. I think what it does is it normalizes the audio to equalize. I don't know. We use this Riverside program. It's supposed to be the best one. I got a podcast microphone here. My brother has some piece of shit microphone from Fisher Price.
It's a snow globe, literally given to me by a continuing medical education company when I had to give a talk for something during COVID.
Yeah,
no. Should be good. Whatever.
Fisher.
Now
Price.
I'm holding it.
All right. So what's the first thing we want to talk about? We want to talk about these new drugs that are coming out, or the step 10 trial.
So the European Association for the Study of Diabetes is happening right now. So all sorts of great things are going to be coming out. They're going to be presented and simultaneously published in big journals, et cetera, for diabetes, obesity, et cetera. And one of them, now we were just, the reason the whole pronunciation of these molecules came up is because of the molecule amycretin. So I'm not so sure we know exactly how to pronounce that one.
Amycretin or amycretin.
I don't know. But it is a dual amylin GLP-1 receptor agonist oral drug. So this is a big deal in the world of obesity medicine right now because, you know, while we have Rybelsus, the oral semaglutide for type 2 diabetes, which is being studied at higher doses for obesity. We don't really have, in fact, we don't have any oral GLP-1 receptor agonists or other incretins approved for obesity yet, but a lot are in the pipeline. We've talked in the past in some of our other podcasts about orforglipron, sponsored by the Swedish chef, and the high dose of semaglutide, which one of the, now, you know, it's interesting. A lot of people think that these oral drugs might be preferred by patients because they don't want to take shots. I will tell you, in the real world, especially in endocrinology, because we do a lot of shots ranging from insulin to these GLP-1 receptor agonists, we rarely ever prescribe Rybelsus for type 2 diabetes because actually these little bitty subcutaneous shots end up being much more preferred and I think to some degree a little bit better tolerated or at least easier to adhere to for patients than a daily pill, which in the case of semaglutide requires a whole little bit of hoops to jump through. You have to wait for a while. Yeah,
and you have to have a tiny little bit of water. You can't do that much.
Yeah, it's a little bit annoying. But anyways, that's a whole different thing. Orforglipron has a different formulation so that it doesn't have some of those restrictions. But what I think a lot of people are hopeful for is that, not that this is going to improve adherence, but maybe help with the cost issue, because pills are generally cheaper to manufacture than these, you know, than like pens and vials and syringes and all that stuff. So at least that's the impression I've been given from the, you know, some of the data on the manufacturers. I don't know if you've heard any of that stuff.
Well, yeah. So orforglipron is a small molecule GLP-1 agonist. And what that means, it's not a long chain peptide that has amino acids that you have to put this special buffering system called a SNAC. It's a really, it's really interesting.
And that's the semaglutide thing.
Yeah. The semaglutide, that's Rybelsus. Now, I don't know if amycretin, I have to look into what type of molecule it is. I think, I'm not sure if it's a long peptide or not, because what they did is they had to add a couple of, looks like a couple of fatty acids to make it more, to bind more to albumin. This whole thing they had to do with semaglutide. So that will be kind of interesting. But orforglipron, that was like the big thing, because it's a small molecule, GLP-1, they think it should be more readily manufactured.
They claim that for all of these oral meds, you know, that's the hope. I don't know. This gets beyond our level of, you know, understanding and expertise for sure, but we're hopeful. Certainly if that's what, you know, I mean, a lot of other researchers who are doing this are hopeful for that. Other experts that I've read about are hopeful for that. And regardless, if the pipeline keeps churning these out, if the benefits outweigh risks with phase 1 through 2 and 3, trials, then we're going to have more product with hopefully good benefits, good safety records, and more availability for patients, and hopefully bring down the costs. And that's one of the hopes of this. So basically, it's a dual amylin GLP-1 receptor agonist. We've talked a lot about the actions of GLP-1 hormones in the body, and also when we have these pharmacotherapeutic levels of long-acting GLP-1 receptors going up to the brain and the pancreas and working on glucagon and gastric emptying to help with weight reduction, appetite, satiety improvement, and blood sugar control specifically. And so, you know, we actually have an amylin analog. Amylin is a hormone that's also secreted by the beta cells in the pancreas. And so for people with type 1 diabetes who have autoimmune dysfunction of their pancreatic beta cells, when they lose their insulin, they also lose the hormone called amylin. And so that helps to regulate blood sugars well, very similarly to the actions of these different incretins like GLP-1 hormones, but without the extra mechanism of improving pancreatic beta cell function. So GLP-1 receptor agonists improve insulin secretion from the pancreas, which is specifically helpful in people with type 2 diabetes and potentially early type 1 diabetes. But the other action that they mention is potentially helpful is that amylin is thought to increase leptin sensitivity. So leptin is the hormone that comes from our adipose cells that is supposed to help with satiety and part of the whole energy balance and weight regulation system. And so, you know, once upon a time, I mean, several years ago, I think when I was in medical school, Spencer, if you remember, there was a lot of there was a drug that combined pramlintide
with metreleptin.
An analog, an amylin analog combined with a leptin analog, which we do have available for some very rare severe diseases where people have very low leptin levels that we're not going to get into today. but this combination has not come to fruition. But we have a pramlintide hormone that is approved and available specifically for people with type 1 or even type 2 diabetes who are on mealtime insulin requirements. And so really, it doesn't get used a lot because what it helps with, it helps with glycemic regulation. So it helps balance out blood sugars a little bit more, especially for people with type 1 diabetes who are struggling with weight and some insulin resistance. The problem is it has to be given specifically for those people as another shot three times a day with their meals, or, you know, obviously they only two times a day with meals, higher doses for people with type 2 diabetes, at least a couple of times a day. And so it's just a whole nother level of shot. And so it never really gets used that much, but it has those benefits. And so the key, my personal thought is here that the key that we were missing is that it was, you know, too short acting, just like the real hormone. And so it was required to be three times a day. And in obesity and type 2 diabetes, it essentially became obsolete because GLP-1 receptor agonists, and now, of course, GLP-1, GIP, and the future do the same things, but better and long acting. And they're once weekly or, you know, in the future, maybe even monthly. So it never really took off, even in endocrinology. I mean, I don't even recall if I ever even prescribed pramlintide because I wanted to just out of pure academic scientific curiosity. But by the time I was in fellowship, we already had daily liraglutide in the form of Victoza or Saxenda, and so that was already better. And it even had better weight reduction and glycemic control. So it really made pramlintide obsolete by the time I was there. So anyways, but that's what the amylin hormone is. And so the thought of combining amylin analogs with GLP-1 receptor agonists or more is that now we're potentially increasing leptin sensitivity. And then we have the increased insulin secretion of the GLP-1 receptor agonists along with the delayed gastric emptying, which, to reiterate, it's not a side effect. It's an important mechanism of action of these medications. Yeah. So that does happen. That's what we actually want that to happen. And it also modulates the opposite hormone, glucagon secretion. And so this trial that was presented at the European Association for the Study of Diabetes, it's just a phase one trial. It was like 95 people split up between 50 milligrams once daily, versus 50 milligrams twice daily, and then 29 people in a placebo group. So this is very small. These phase one trials are really looking at side effects, but it also had very good weight reduction in otherwise relatively healthy people with obesity. And so there was about a 10% weight reduction over 12 weeks with the 50 milligrams daily version, 13% with the 50 milligrams
two
tabs daily.
By the way,
in 12 weeks, that's a lot of weight loss.
That's more than a percent per week.
Yeah. And remember, when we talk about amount of weight reduction, what that means as a surrogate predictor of health outcomes, which we actually care about, when we start getting over 5% weight loss, we start seeing a lot of health benefits. You start getting over 10% weight loss, we are preventing diabetes in those who have prediabetes. We're dramatically reducing liver fat in those who have fatty liver, potentially reducing the risk of fibrosis. We're reducing the risk and minimizing the side effects of sleep apnea. We're potentially improving fertility and PCOS and getting a lot of blood pressure, lipid, and blood sugar benefits in type 2 diabetes. And so then 13% with the 50 milligrams, two pills a day, essentially, versus 1% of placebo. Now we're knocking on the door of that 15%. And that's in just 12 12 weeks. So, I mean, that's darn good efficacy that we think will translate to the larger trials. This is going to take a long time. This is phase two, or phase one,
Phase one.
Really small trial. But there was a significant number of side effects, as we would expect. So all these types of medicines, you know, with that gastric emptying slowing, 50 to 87% between those two doses had some sort of mild to moderate nausea or vomiting. Now, what's amazing is that 34% of the placebo group had that too. You know, I mean, that's why we do these trials, because it also shows the placebo group, but, you know, so whatever that means.
Yeah. You know, the other thing as I will say is that there are researchers looking at these drugs that may hit receptors differently and which may not have nausea in the future. It's just that they can't selectively do it just yet. So there are parts of the brain that contribute to our nausea. And so what they're trying to do is figure out if they can create these molecules or peptides in ways that don't hit those receptors while also hitting the satiety receptors. So it'll be interesting. The drug that's coming out sooner than later is called CagriSema. It combines a long-acting amylin agonist called cagrilintide along with semaglutide. And that one's having that one's in phase three right now and probably should be reported, I believe, in the next however many months. Is that right?
Yeah, it's supposed to be. I mean, it would be interesting. It would be I guess I don't know. I didn't look enough at the EASD to see if it's possible that it would be presented here.
I don't think so.
I feel like we would have heard about that already.
Yeah.
But the phase two trial's been a couple of years ago. That had really good weight reduction. And, you know, if we're talking about big pharma, right, that would be Novo's competition to then try to catch up to the Mounjaro, Zepbound, tirzepatide stuff. And then, of course, they're all, you know, the good news is they're all competing in a lot of things in the pipeline. So that's good news for everybody.
Yeah. So that one, they combine the two different analogs, whereas amycretin is similar to like tirzepatide in that it's just one molecule. I don't know if it's a peptide or molecule, but it hits the different receptors by itself. They don't have to combine two things together. Kind of an interesting, whereas cagrilintide and semaglutide, CagriSema, they have to put the two in one formulation. So that's a phase one. Like, we're not going to see it for a while, but everybody's really excited about the pipeline here. There is another long acting amylin analog called petrelintide, similar to cagrilintide. It's made by Zealand Pharma. It's another phase one trial that people have been talking about. So a lot of cool things coming down the pipeline for that. There was some more data on retatrutide, looking at like inflammation decreases and lipid decreases. That glucagon component. So for anybody that needs a refresher, retatrutide made a big deal because it hits three different receptors, not just the GLP-1 and GIP like tirzepatide does, but it also hits glucagon receptors. And there's something about the glucagon, hitting the glucagon actually has major lipid, including LDL cholesterol improvements, whereas the other agonists don't have that. So it'll be really interesting to see if this has cardiovascular benefits.
It gets it really into that, you know, it starts actually modulating some of the actual metabolism. You know, when people talk about increasing metabolism, there may be some of that with the glucagon receptors, especially in the liver.
Yeah. From what I know, I'm just looking at a few different mechanisms of how that glucagon may work. It may be increases the degradation of the PCSK9. Mm-hmm. We'll have to do a cholesterol episode. You know, I'm a lipidologist. My brother's an endocrinologist, really into lipids. And we should probably get one of our lipid buddies in here. We can go over some of the nuances of that. But some really interesting
mechanism. Really confuse the hell out of people.
Yeah. Yeah. It gets pretty confusing. Anyway, that one's going
to
help
keep it
with lipids. Pretty cool stuff.
Let's talk about these bullshit supplements that are out there, because this is running rampant. Now that we've talked a little bit about these actual hormones, some of the real medications that have these significant benefits, now every time I turn on, you know, I turn on Facebook, I see somebody selling some sort of supplement that they claim is as good as Ozempic, for weight loss and diabetes. And yet we know that that's impossible, because if there was such a thing, we'd all be telling everyone to use it. But people are trying to make money, and they're making millions and billions and trillions.
A lot of money.
Whatever, because big wellness, big supplement is like potentially even more lucrative than big pharma, amazingly, because people, I don't know, we got to help people not be suckered into this stuff, but it is very lucrative and it's very shady.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, because we know these things don't work.
As we were setting this podcast up, we were talking about what we were going to talk about today. And one of my patients sent me a post about Kourtney Kardashian coming out with her supplement that's an Ozempic alternative. And I don't even know what's in it. So I just reposted and said, this is BS. There's no supplement out there that even gets close to what you see with a GLP-1 agonist. Again, we don't take any money from Big Pharma. We're not against supplements if they are actually beneficial, but there is literally no supplement that will get anywhere near the effects of these GLP-1 agonists. This gets down into the physiology. We've talked about this many times, but our natural GLP-1 is broken down very quickly, within a minute or two. So even if you find ways to increase your own endogenous GLP-1, it'll be broken down very quickly. We actually have drugs that inhibit the breakdown called DPP-4 inhibitors. And these even themselves, while increasing our own endogenous GLP-1, don't even lead to weight loss. Yeah. They do have a glycemic benefit.
So let's talk about that, because we have real pharmaceutical drugs that were approved around the time of the original GLP-1 receptor agonist, exenatide. I don't even remember when sitagliptin was first approved. That was the first one. And we have several. These are medications that they inhibit the DPP-4 enzyme, which is the enzyme that breaks down our body's natural GLP-GIP. And they increase our circulating incretin hormones about 3 to 5-fold, but it's still, it's not perfect, and they still get degraded and metabolized and relatively short acting. They have, in type 2 diabetes, they have modest glycemic benefit, and we do need sugar control in people with type 2 diabetes. I will tell you that in endocrinology, we don't ever use these because they just are basically worthless compared to the GLP-1 receptor agonists that we have from a blood sugar perspective. Certainly, like you just said, they do not cause any weight reduction, despite definitively increasing our body's own endogenous GLP-1 hormones. And they also haven't shown the other important benefits, like the cardiovascular risk reduction, the kidney risk reduction. Some of them even have this signal of concerning heart failure risk, which doesn't make a lot of sense. And we tend to just not use those that have that little hint of a risk. They had very similar cardiovascular risk reduction in comparison to, I think, some sulfonylureas, which are medicines that have been around forever and are very, very cheap, that just tell your pancreas to make more insulin without any other trigger. And so there was actually concern of cardiovascular risk with those. But it turns out not really, at least with the good ones. And DPP-4 inhibitors really don't add any benefits to that. So literally using real drugs that increase our body's own natural GLP-1 and GIP do not cause any weight loss. They have a little bit of glycemic benefit, so from about 0.5 to 0.9 A1C reduction. Pretty modest, though. So we once in a while will use these in certain people where we just, like in elderly people who we don't really want to give a lot of medications to, because these are very, very well tolerated, and we just need a little bit of glycemic benefit to keep them safe for the rest of their lives. But otherwise, we don't use these. The other problem with them is they're still kind of expensive. So it's not like we're getting a ton of cost benefit either with them. And so when we talk about natural ways to increase GLP-1 and GIP, et cetera, from our diet and all these things, which we should do, by the way, most of the dietary things we talk about do have some probably improved GLP-1 secretion a little bit, I guess. But the supplements that do it are not going to do it to any degree at all compared to the long-standing, like 30-fold increase of the receptor agonism of these weekly GLP-1 receptor agonists like semaglutide or the GLP-GIP tirzepatide and the GLP-GIP glucagon retatrutide and all these different oral ones we're talking about. So they just don't even come close. But boy, people are really jumping on the bandwagon just to profit. I mean, think about it. We could do that. But we could
make a lot of money.
Yeah, I stay broke out of ethics. Can somebody guys sponsor the podcast?
There is a company that's promoting their GLP-1 probiotic. They have some studies on it, and I've told people this before that it probably won't help with weight, but it potentially could help with glycemia. That would make sense. It's this acromantia mucinophilia phyla, whatever. That's their pendulum company.
It also doesn't mean it's harmful, but boy, not. It doesn't seem like any of this stuff would be worth any money, especially when we should be able to do most of the basic healthfulness of a good diet, dietary component.
Yeah. So anyway, for anybody listening, if there's a supplement out there that says they're going to increase your own GLP-1, honestly, could it hurt you? I don't even know. I mean, the thing,
it's possible. Could hurt you. That's the problem.
Contaminated. I don't know. That's why you need these big, long studies. I would just honestly stay away from all these types of supplements. There's no reason to, you're not going to lose weight with, I can promise you one thing. You will not lose weight with these supplements the way you think you're going to. So just don't waste your money on them. I'd save your money for the real thing if you're going to do that.
Yeah, that's a great point, because they're darn near almost as expensive, probably.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe not.
I was just looking at the amycretin. They are coming out with a subcutaneous version of it as well. I forgot that was just because I was looking for the phase 3. It looks like the CagriSema is it's called REDEFINE 1. Mm-hmm. That's the first study. They call this, you know how they have STEP trials, SURMOUNT, all these things. They call the CagriSema trials or the REDEFINE trials. And the REDEFINE 1, it looks like estimated completion date is like next month.
Oh, nice. Maybe it'll get, it might get presented at like the ADA in the spring or something like that.
Yeah,
Endocrine that would be Society, ACE, ADA, something in the spring probably.
Yeah. Okay. What about this? Was there anything else we want to talk about? Step 10. There was a few little things that came out.
Yeah, I mean, we can kind of talk about that. So, you know, people who are struggling with obesity and prediabetes, specifically prediabetes, metabolic syndrome, insulin resistance, they have a much higher risk of progressing to type 2 diabetes. Obviously, that's why we have this entity on the spectrum of sugar abnormalities called prediabetes. And so over the years, we've had several trials because the one therapy we know that helps with diabetes prevention is diet, exercise, and weight loss. So over many years, we've had really big trials from around the world that are basically diet and exercise trials looking to reduce the progression from prediabetes to type 2 diabetes. Trials that people might have heard of called the Finnish Diabetes Prevention Trial, the big United States-sponsored diabetes prevention program, which actually has led to insurance-covered programs for lifestyle, behavioral therapy, nutrition, exercise, and weight loss leading to diabetes prevention. And then there's the Chinese Daqing Diabetes Prevention Study, which we actually have some very recent long-term data on that. And all these lifestyle programs, if they lead to more than 5, 7, especially 10% weight reduction, which is where we kind of get that number, then they have dramatic reduction in the progression of people from prediabetes, which is measured in a few different ways. A lot of these older ones, they had impaired glucose tolerance, meaning they did a 2-hour sugar tolerance test. But they dramatically reduce the risk of going to type 2 diabetes. In the diabetes prevention program, for example, it was even more powerful than when they compared it to metformin, which is literally a type 2 diabetes drug that's been around forever, has a great track record, has good benefits, safety record, with some nuances depending on if you're older, younger, female, history of gestational diabetes. But the Daqing recently reported out like 30-year results. And those people who were originally randomized to the intensive lifestyle intervention had a significant reduced risk of all-cause death by about 23% relative risk, along with cardiovascular death and cardiovascular events. So that's kind of the background. So we are the Docs Who Lift. We are shills for exercise, nutrition, weight reduction done through those things. But obviously, that's easier said than done. So people with obesity in this obesogenic environment have a very difficult time fighting their biology to lose the weight. Hence why we talk so much about these GLP-1 receptor agonists like semaglutide. So step 10 was another phase 3 trial. It was all over the place. I mean, it was 30 trial sites, Canada, Denmark, Finland, Spain, United Kingdom. People had obesity, prediabetes, essentially defined by hemoglobin A1C in the prediabetes range. And actually not just barely prediabetes, like they had an A1C of 6 to 6.4. So we consider prediabetes starting at an A1C of 5.7. And they were randomly assigned 2-to-1 to weekly semaglutide, titrated up to 2.4 milligrams weekly, or placebo. They all had kind of the same diabetes prevention, diet and exercise prescription for weight reduction, counseling for 52 weeks. And they also had a 28-week off treatment period. And the endpoints that they were looking for were, of course, weight loss. And then, of course, in this case, because it's so good at sugar control, they were really looking at how many people not only progressed to type 2 diabetes, but more importantly, they were looking at who had normal glucose based upon hemoglobin A1C and fasting blood glucose. And the bottom line is that there was obviously a dramatic weight reduction. So 14% versus 2.5% weight loss with the semaglutide group. And then as far as people who had essentially normal glycemia, 81% of the people in the semaglutide group had normalized glycemia versus just 14% of the people in the diet and exercise group alone. You know, similar adverse effects as in the other trials, not a lot. Adverse effects events leading to treatment discontinuation occurred in just 8 participants in the semaglutide group, and that was only 6% of them. And then which was 1% in the placebo group, which is, you know, relatively standard, you know, single digit side effects causing them to drop out. But I think the point is that, you know, we start getting over 10% weight reduction. That is very predictive of reducing the risk of progressing from prediabetes to type 2 diabetes in those who are at the highest risk. We have a lot of these medications that have shown to do that. You know, we had it with liraglutide earlier. We also have it with phenermine topiramate. And as far as just medications that are good for sugar control, we have the data in metformin, just like I talked about, not as good as the diet and exercise with weight loss in the diabetes prevention program. And some of the other older medications we have, like acarbose, which is essentially a starch breakdown blocker in the gut that helps prevent it. And as you can imagine, some of these things just make sense. And semaglutide obviously makes sense for normalizing glucose, because even in people with pretty bad type 2 diabetes, it has remarkable glycemic benefits. So, you know, it's not very surprising, and it certainly gets the right amount of weight reduction we would expect to have these improvements. But I think it's important to note. And then the other top line result that came out was actually for tirzepatide or Zepbound. Now, I don't think we have that hasn't been published yet. But I if I'm not mistaken, we'll see when it gets published. But darn near everyone normalized their glucose.
It was something like a 94%.
Yeah, something like that. People in the 90s. So, you know, I mean, it's not that surprising, because these are literally anti-glycemic medications.
Like,
but
people were making a big deal, like, "Wow, isn't this incredible?" I'm like, "No, that I would expect that. These drugs are
exactly
so powerful.
What we expected.
They're just
yeah.
ridiculously powerful."
So you're treating the underlying root issue of the obesity, and you know, the genetic threshold at which, you know, insulin resistance ultimately leads to pancreatic beta cell failure and loss of insulin. And so we're literally treating that with a 10-15% weight reduction. And then we also have the added benefit of the glycemic control, stimulating the pancreas to make more insulin, and just all around, obviously good for diabetes. pre-diabetes, preventing diabetes, and then ultimately all the other healthy benefits that we see, heart attack risk reduction, heart failure potentially, and kidney disease.
Yeah, I was just looking up a few of these other newer drugs that are coming out. There's this longer acting GLP-1 receptor agonist from China that's coming out.
Pronounced China?
China. China. And it's like got a half-life of like 12 days. And it looks like similar, kind of that similar. This is, again, phase one. So like you never know.
Yeah.
They're actually, I can't remember the name of it. There is one recent one that they actually stopped production because I don't know if there was harm or it wasn't as good. Mm-hmm. So that's why you have to go through these phase three trials and ideally have cardiovascular outcome trials to make sure. But this one also just massive weight loss, and they started doing it like every 4 weeks even.
Yeah.
At one point, it looks like they're losing more than you would with semaglutide. It looks at 30 weeks of 17% weight loss. Anyway, interesting stuff. The other thing is there is another, we should probably get Stu Phillips back on some scholarly debate about the lean mass loss.
No.
But I think we need to, because there is another drug called pemvidutide, which is a GLP. Mm-hmm. It's confusing. There's so many coming out. GLP-1 glucagon. It doesn't add the GIP on there, but that one, they actually did. They're starting to look at they're starting to get more DEXA scans, and that one only had about a 21% lean mass loss, despite more weight loss, or at least similar on par weight loss with the other ones. So I think
some of them are balancing, you know, the glucagon. It's interesting, glucagon agonism versus glucagon antagonism. Some are going to be maybe helpful for those with fatty liver and high risk of fibrosis, or those already with liver fibrosis, more so than even like the weight and all that stuff. But that's going to all get teased out in these phase two, three trials. And hopefully we'll end up with some good options that will definitely be confusing to a lot of people, I'm sure. But there's going to be
lots
a lot of
interesting
education.
Names out there. Yeah. Another one called it's a GIP, just mono agonist, meaning so tirzepatide was a GLP-1/GIP. And so there's a study that came out of this where it's just a single GIP long acting agonist, Macupatide, and they showed that by itself it led to a little bit of weight loss and glycemic benefit, improved insulin sensitivity, and then they added it with dulaglutide or Trulicity, as people know it, and it had additive benefit. So they think that that's why tirzepatide, the GIP, you know, maybe the component that is additive. Really, just interesting stuff. I'm very fascinated by the future of what we're going to see in like 5 to 10 years. Everybody wants to keep asking, when is this stuff going to get covered? I think when there's more competition.
Prices, costs have to come down.
These people are competing. You know, it's not going to have the monopolies of Novo and Lilly by themselves.
Well, and, you know, and I think here's my little plug for everyone to fight against the insurance, basically dictation over our whole healthcare system. I'm of the opinion that our insurance companies, government insurance, all of them together are just really ruining everything. The way they pay us, the way they cover pharma, but we also allow pharma to spend millions and millions of dollars on TV commercials when they really should just be, you know, if anything, investing to make sure physicians are educated and have more time to discuss these with patients. No offense to patients, but I just don't think they should be marketed to patients because then you get people coming in and asking for them. It may or may not be appropriate. And it's just so many things. And it just drives the costs up. Oh, God, that's a whole nother soapbox.
We've talked about this many times. I don't know. We know Lilly reps are listening to this. So come on.
And Novo reps. Hey, lots
Novo,
of reps.
Hey, we got to. Hey, where's our Boehringer reps? We need our Amgen reps. We need our Zealand reps.
Oh, God. They all listen.
What about Viking? We got to get Viking.
All right.
They're coming down the
pipeline. All
right.
Maybe
pipeline.
We should get them all on, have a roundtable discussion. The thing is, the reps don't, you know, it's not their fault. They're not in charge of that.
They're just doing their job.
It's the marketers and those
people. I know,
people.
But they
should
go back
appreciate our reps who bring us samples and food for my staff. And no, I don't consider that a conflict of interest. So we love you.
I just need fake pens so that I can pretend like I'm injecting myself.
Oh, my God.
For YouTube and TikToks and the Instagrams and the Twitters.
I have those. So you can come to my clinic and we'll just do some videos.
I'll show you an injection.
Oh, Yeah, well, we'll see. I can't wait till my video about when I'm starting my own gym clinic that we've always talked about doing, and you don't want to do it because you don't like lifting weights anymore.
You're an hour and 15 minutes away.
You don't like doing it.
Oh, jeez.
I don't like lifting weights anymore. All right. Anything Everybody else? Lift some weights. Pump some iron. Lift That's going to be the key to retaining your muscle during any weight loss effort. Lifestyle's medicine. Get it done. Got to find a way.
Pemphetatide, tirzepatide, amycretin, retatrutide, whatever. Bimagrumab, whatever.
Oh, God.
All right. All right.
Godspeed.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities. We'll be right back.